88.9 FM reminds you that the views expressed on WEAA programs are those of participants and not necessarily those of Morgan State University, the staff, management, or underwriters of Baltimore's home for cool jazz. WEAA 88.9 FM.
The Mark Steiner Show is brought to you by MeQ, Baltimore's credit union. Welcome back, everybody. It's Mark Steiner. Good to have you with us here on the Mark Steiner Show on your source for cool jazz and more, WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community. We want to remind you, before we jump into this conversation real fast, that our twice-a-year fun drive is coming up next week. And we want you to get in the mood now that from this show next week, The Wire's Wendell Pierce, Ta-Nehisi Coates, and others will be part of this membership drive, and we will have their books. I'm sure you receive copies of their books and much more as tokens for your support to WEAA 88.9 FM. And so join us Monday through Friday next week, 10 to noon, for our fun drive to support The Mark Steiner Show and WEAA. You can get a head start right now by showing your support at WEAA.org. We are here with A. Dwight Pettit, a noted Baltimore defense attorney who's representing clients in many police misconduct cases. Trey Murphy is an organizer with the Baltimore Algebra Project and Baltimore Block. And Kimberly Kindy, it's Kindy, right?
That's right.
Good. Make sure I had that right, Kimberly. I'm sorry. Government accountability reporter at the Washington Post. Good to have you all three here with us.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
410-319-8888 is a number to call. You can also email us at talk@steinershow.org. Tweet me at Mark Steiner. 410-319-8888. So, Kimberly, could you begin the work you've been doing at the Post? Break down exactly what happened for us with Tamir Rice and the investigations.
Well, it's still ongoing. The prosecutor has not yet presented the case to the grand jury, but he has done something that's quite different in that when there is evidence or investigative reports that he's commissioned that come his way, he's releasing them publicly. So what came out on Saturday was actually three reports, two of them looking at whether or not the officers under legal terms, if their conduct was reasonable given the situation. And both of them determined, based upon primarily Supreme Court rulings that guide this, that it was, in fact, reasonable.
And what were the grounds they found it reasonable? How do they find that?
Well, it's very, very different from, determining whether or not there was a way that perhaps it could have been avoided, or evaluating if department policy was followed, or if it was, an appropriate shooting, or any of those other things that I think that most people think about when they see an instant case like this. What they were looking at was what the legal standard is, and that is whether or not an officer had probable cause to believe that the suspect posed a threat or a serious threat of physical harm on either themselves or on other people. And they determined that, given that standard of reasonableness, that it was reasonable for the officer in that instance to believe that it was a real gun and that his life or that of others was in jeopardy, and therefore they determined, both these experts, that under that legal definition, it was a reasonable shooting. The law and the courts basically say that they're not supposed to look at 20/20 vision, not hindsight, but rather in that split second when the officer is making a decision, was it reasonable for him to believe, in this case, that the gun was real, that the threat was real, and that any other officer would find that, finding themselves in that situation, would also shoot.
One of the things that, of course, that was interesting, one of the things I read about this report, and I'm really curious, Dwight, legally what you think, and you think as a community activist here about this and how this plays out. One of the things that also happened in this report, what I understand, Kimberly, is that they did not include, to tell the people who were judging whether or not this was justified, that the caller also said that he was probably a juvenile and that weapon was, quote-unquote, probably fake. In fact,
right, except for the officers were never told that. That although that was communicated at some point among, you know, internally or with the 911 operator, the investigation so far has shown that that information never got transmitted to the officers. A critical problem in the emergency system, they weren't told that. This is probably not a real weapon, that this is probably a juvenile. That's a serious problem. But what these experts looked at was whether or not in this situation, in the moment in which the officer was confronted with someone who he believed had a gun, that was a real gun, whether or not the shooting, his reaction, his handling of it was reasonable.
Dwight, what's your initial reaction to all this?
Well, as the...
As an attorney.
Yeah, as was just indicated, the law has become, I've said this before and I've said it on your show here, Mark, the law has become very, very conservative as it relates to objective and subjective determinations of police officers. I disagree with the law, disagree with the Court of Appeals in Maryland, and I thought the Supreme Court had made some advance determinations just recently when I forget the name of the case at this point in time. But when they talked about it, it was a subjective standard and not a subjective standard. And as she just indicated, what would other officers do in the same situation? Not just what the officer in question did, but what would officers do in a similar situation, making it an objective standard? But this is a very difficult area because the courts, particularly in Maryland, and the Supreme Court has said that you cannot Monday morning quarterback. And has made it very difficult in trial because the moment you ask a question to an officer, would you have done this or would you have done that, then there's an objection, and that objection is sustained because you're asking the court to allow the officer or the question is allowing the officer to be second-guessed. And the courts have been very conservative. Now, in this particular instance, I think we have to look back at the Supreme Court's most recent ruling. I wished I'd brought it or could remember the name of it. But it goes into the objective standard. And the objective standard is a little bit more tolerant and liberal than the subjective standard. But that can be confusing, and I know I'm confusing your audience because it's a very confusing area.
There is sort of a bottom line thing here. Prosecutors know that this legal standard will be applied. And so the bottom line for a prosecutor deciding whether they're going to move forward with a case is, will the jury believe the officer when he says that he thought the threat was real? And if the answer is yes, it's not a winnable case. The law is, the way it is written, absolutely gives the officers a pass, and if they can convince a jury that they believe the threat was real.
And that's what I've said to you over and over, Mark. It's very difficult in terms of the criminal prosecution as well as the civil prosecution in terms of police officers, and folks don't realize that.
Yeah, I want to just jump in here for a little bit. I think one of the things that too often, Mark, we fail to remember is that even going back into the origins of how laws first came about inside this country, going dating all the way back to post-Revolutionary War time, that we fail to realize that what's legal isn't always what's right, right? And too often we confuse the two because history has proven to us that inside this country in particular, we have made laws based off of everything from profiting off of this country's original sin, the profiting off of free labor, off of the hands of slavery, off of the backs of black people inside this country, all the way up to now where we're in a capitalist system that still profits off of poor people at the bottom to ensure that the people at the top remain wealthy. So it all goes back to this moral concept of is every law inside this country that is legal right? Because in my mind, my one question to these independent investigators as they determined that this was reasonably justified on the part of the officers, my one question is, if that had been a white child in a suit holding a toy gun, would they have fired so quickly? And would that have been ruled as reasonably justifiable, right? And too oftentimes our officers are trained to look at specific people, particularly black people inside this country, as a threat, as enemies, before actually assessing fully the situation and making sure that they comprehend it and making sure that above all else, de-escalation is the first thing on the forefront of these police officers' minds as they walk into situations like that, as opposed to the over excessive use of force. So I want us to make sure that we understand the concept that what is legal doesn't always mean that it's right.
Well, that is the point, and I think that's where we're at right now in history. I think a lot of people who were not paying attention to why officers weren't being charged are paying attention now. And so, another bottom line here is there is a huge difference between whether or not the officer should have shot or used lethal force and whether or not it's legally justifiable. So we're at a place in our nation now where people are upset and shocked every time officers in situations like this end up looking like or end up not facing charges. The truth is, if we want that to change, the laws have to change.
And that's exactly right. I think that's a big piece. We were talking before we went on the air just about there are a lot of demonstrations here in Cleveland and many other cities in America, but the proof in the pudding to change that is people organizing themselves to change those laws, because I think that is part of where we are right now in a political sense.
Yeah, I think people need to stop being surprised when an officer isn't charged,
right,
and start looking at that it isn't necessarily the will of the prosecutor or necessarily the will of anybody else to bring charges against the officer, but rather a body of laws that make it nearly impossible to prosecute officers even when the shooting looks bad, even when there are clear evidence, like in this case, that maybe the situation could have been handled differently. Plenty of police critics out there looking at this case saying, why did they drive right up to the scene? They placed themselves in a situation where they were just feet away from a 12-year-old who they thought had a real gun. There's lots of experts who've said they should have created lots of distance, got behind their patrol car, yelled for him to drop it, that there were a lot of ways to handle that situation, to disarm him of that toy gun, to assess the situation from a distance without being in a situation where, oh, well, yeah, you're 3 feet away from, or however far away, I think it was maybe 7 feet,
right,
away from somebody who has a gun that looks real. Well, then you're in a position where you have no choice but to fire because you really think they've got a gun. So, but again, the law doesn't allow for you to say, well, they should be criminally charged because they get handled differently. It only looks at the moment where they use the lethal force, and whether or not in that split second, whether it was of their own doing because they didn't handle the situation right, or whether it's the doing of the innocent bystander or suspect,
right?
At the end of the day, it is about that moment. Even if, again, if they created the situation, even if they mishandled the situation, legally they have protection. If in that split second they believe their life wasn't at risk or the life of somebody else was at risk.
So let me switch gears just for a second here. I'm going to come back to Tamir Rice, but I'm curious. I'm going to go to Dwight and then over to Trey. Dwight, could you explain for our listeners exactly what just happened with the case here in Baltimore with Freddie Gray and the decision Judge Williams made and what that means?
Well, basically, the decision yesterday was based on suppression motions, and the motions were to, in fact, suppress the statements that were made by five of the six police officers involved in the Freddie Gray case.
These were statements they made before they were indicted and while they were being questioned by the internal.
While they were being investigated by the internal investigations of the police department, as well as other investigators that might have been involved at the time. And the question becomes is whether or not they were advised that these statements could be used against them, or whether or not they were protected, because what you have is the police officers or the law enforcement officers' Bill of Rights, which means that those statements that they made in terms of investigatory statements cannot be used in a criminal prosecution. But at the same time, you have Miranda floating around where they are advised if they're in custodial if it's a custodial interrogation, that they have a right to remain silent, just like any citizen. And so what Judge Williams was looking at yesterday was whether or not they were properly advised. The officers claimed they were intimidated, they had been sort of tricked, that this was a ruse, that they didn't know that these statements were going to come back. And his determination was to make a – his responsibility was to make a determination where these officers practically or properly advised, did they know that the statements were taken in terms of possible prosecution? Were they advised that the difference between investigatory statements in terms of the police bill of rights criminal statements or statements that could be used in criminal prosecution? So that's what he did yesterday, was a fact determination of whether or not these statements could be admitted, because that is the basis and appears to be the strength of the state's case, that officers made certain statements, particularly Porter, and Officer Porter made certain statements to Officer Goodson and to Officer White that, in fact, Mr. Gray was in peril and needed medical attention. And that could establish, if those statements were made and Officer White and Officer Goodson were aware of Mr. Gray's peril, and the statute says, or the law says, that it was an extreme condition and they were made aware of it, and they did nothing to, in fact, alleviate him from that condition, then that could establish the basis for both manslaughter and depraved heart murder. And so that's why that is so crucial, because that's the evidence that the state wants to use in negotiating with Officer Porter, and that will determine whether Porter makes a plea, whether he flips, whether he becomes state evidence, and that also are the statements that will come in against the other remaining officers as to what they knew and when they knew it.
And Trey, so talk a bit about I want you to tell our listeners, I'm sorry for the truncated part of the show here, but we'll talk much more about this in coming weeks with you. Talk a bit about the letter that Baltimore Black sent to the mayor and what that was about.
Sure. So currently, you know, we have an interim police commissioner who the mayor has nominated to be the permanent police commissioner, Kevin Davis, with a nice little severance package and, you know, a nice cushy 5-year job all the way up to 2020, right? But one of the things that we noticed is that in the wake of Freddie Gray, once he took over after she fired the police commissioner who she appointed about a year ago for a political move because she thought she was running for mayor, and turns out that she wasn't, and a whole bunch of other stuff. One of the things that we understood is that Kevin Davis immediately launched a fallout attack on protesters, arresting peaceful protesters, one being Kwame Davis, another one being Pastor West, who have been nothing but peacefully exercising their First Amendment right. And we then understood that Kevin Davis has a track record of attack on peaceful protesters, right, since he's been at the Baltimore Police Department, and then even before. And that then becomes a concern for us. Because then we get into this whole battle and conflict around, should young people in particular be worried that because they're elevating their voices, the only power that they have inside this country, should they be worried about the direct attack on their life and their future? Right, having all of these targets on their back because they're exercising their First Amendment rights. So what we did was we came together and we said, okay, we don't necessarily care for Kevin Davis to be inside the position that he's in, but nevertheless, he's inside that position. So one of the things that we want to do is to demand and even in some ways force him to implement. First, publicly retract his stance on peaceful protesters, and then implement a level of rules of engagements that we have submitted to him inside the open letter. Everything ranging from making sure that the first preservation is human life over property, because one of the things that we have seen throughout all of this stuff is that too often police will be the first to protect property before they actually protect human life or care for human life. Ranging from that to no use of certain riot gear, and the use of tear gas as only a last resort if necessary, to a whole bunch of other stuff, 19 basic bullet points. And we want the interim police commissioner to commit to implementing those 19 rules of engagement, as one, as a sign of good faith on the part of protesters, that he can practice what he preached, that he's not anti-protesters, right? But also on a different level, for him to recognize that he's inside the position that he's in, because people in positions of power believes that he should be inside that position. And because he represents those people, and those people are theoretic in their response to represent the massive amount of people inside of Baltimore, he is supposed to work for us, and therefore he should listen to the demands of the community.
Well, one thing might be good for us too, in the Steiner Show, let me get these final words from our guest here, is to see if we can call the police department from the Steiner Show and ask their response to what you're writing to them, and maybe have a dialogue about that with them about that, because things did clearly change when he became commissioner in terms of the rules of engagement when people are demonstrating in the street. But let me get some final thoughts on all this. Dwight, just wrapping this up for us in terms of where you think this case may go.
Well, I think the prosecution definitely had a victory yesterday. That gives them a much stronger hand in terms of these statements coming in. If the statements had not been allowed in, there would have been a tremendous victory for the defense. And so the prosecution is starting out in a very good posture. And I expect now that we might see some deals being turned. It's very probable that Porter will reach some type of deal, if not as a given complete protection in terms of prosecution, in terms of his testimony. It might be some deal that might be offered to him, which makes him a very comfortable state's witness. That happens, and we see the other cases will fall in line accordingly.
And Kimberly, I don't know if you tie what's happening in Baltimore into what you've been seeing around the country, but if you can, talk about that before we break.
Well, I haven't been covering Baltimore, so I wouldn't.
Okay, try won't make you do that.
Expert, but you know, obviously, I covered Ferguson in great depth.
Right, in depth.
This is. I think what's different is that people are paying attention, and that there is, just a magnifying glass on all of these cases, and so it's not as if things have changed. We're operating under the same laws and conditions that we had before. It's just that people who didn't used to have a voice were complaining about how police use of force, complaining about how victims' rights are not being honored. Other people, besides those small voices, are paying attention too now. And it's a national issue, and people are being forced to uncomfortably wrestle with this and talk about what is just and unjust on a larger platform, and it's forcing reform.
And Kimberly, let me add to that. The technology that has developed in terms of cameras, cell phones, has also forced the issue. And in Baltimore, since you're not aware of the history here, we are very fortunate that we elected a state's attorney who campaigned on the fact that she would, in fact, pursue wrongdoing wherever she found it.
Yeah, no,
and that's
right.
A difference. It's what happened in a lot of other jurisdictions in the nation.
Yeah, no, that's very true about Baltimore.
And Trey, just a very quick final thought, very quick.
So,
are going to take this from here?
One of the things that I concur with Kimberly, actually, I think that one of the great things is that we're having this debate nationally. One of the things that we saw even during a Democratic debate yesterday is that no presidential nominee would have ever thought that they would have had to take a position on race relations inside this country, running for the highest position inside the country. Right. And so I think one of the things that we have done very well is begin to have these conversations. But it's not enough to just begin to have these conversations. We also have to call for people to be out there on the streets, raising their voice, exercising their First Amendment right, making sure that we're elevating these issues above all else, and that we're asking for accountability and transparency. And the last thing that I will say is that we've had this race relations conversation in the social arena when it came to the civil rights movement. We've had it, even before the civil rights movement, when it was around slavery, we've had this race relations conversation in the political arena when it came to the civil rights movement and the Black Power movement. And now we're having this conversation in the economic arena where it hits home for most people inside America who are part of the 1%. And so that's where we must continue to have these conversations in all three of these arenas, making sure that people are educated around what's happening and making sure that they are agitated enough to take a stance, a public stance.
And Trey,
on what is
let
going
me
on.
Say to you, so, you young folks have made this a national issue.
Yes, that's absolutely true. Amen mm-hmm. to that. So I first want to thank Trey Murphy for joining us here, organizer for the Baltimore Algebra Project and Baltimore Block, Kimberly Kindy, government accountability reporter for the Washington Post. We'll be linking to her work, which has been extensive, from Ferguson and Cleveland, and people read what she's written in our listening area. And Dwight Pettit, Baltimore defense attorney, who always adds his great legal mind to our conversations. Thank the three of you so much.
Thank
for
you
joining
for having
us.
Nice to have me, Mark.
Thank you.
We have to take a very brief break. We're going to come back and continue our conversations about Talking About Race, the OSI series. This time it's domestic workers and race. We'll stay with us.